K-12 Appropriations Subcommittee will come to order. Adrian, will you please call the roll?
Chair Fawn?
Here.
Vice Chair Bell?
Here.
Representative Lupus?
Here.
Andrade?
Here.
Bartleman?
Here.
Bush?
Here.
Fetterhoff?
Here.
Haig?
Here.
McLean?
Here.
Roach? Smith?
Here.
Trunell?
Here.
Valdez?
Present.
Ranking Member Willite? Williams?
Okay, a quorum is present. Members, please make sure all electronic devices are turned off or are on vibrate. I'm going to start with myself. All right. Well, I appreciate everyone coming today for our second meeting of the Pre-K through 12 Appropriations Subcommittee. We have a few things we're going to do today. The first is we're going to get a presentation on the governor's FY 2021 to 2022 Pre-K through 12 budget. We're also going to get an update by the Department of Education on the federal funding related to the COVID-19 pandemic that our early learning providers in K-12 schools have received. I talked a little bit about this in our last meeting. And then at the conclusion of the department's update on the federal funding, I'm going to provide my own presentation with some specific data talking about allocations versus disbursements to date. Before we do that, I'm going to take a personal moment here and introduce a very special guest, my son Jacob, who is the reason I actually ran for the legislature 6 years ago when he was a first grader and I got angry about what he was learning in school. I didn't like, some of you have heard the story, I did not like how they were teaching him math. He was told that 9 + 6 did not equal 15. And in my family, we're never going to make it, sorry, Jacob, on our looks, personality, or athletic skills. So I knew that Jacob needed to learn math. And so here we are. And so here he is now. He's in seventh grade, and he is e-learning. So he could come up and join me this week. And he is actually working on his communications merit badge for Boy Scouts, where he has to attend a public meeting and take good notes. So he is here with us today. And I'm sure he'll tell me he was really bored when this is all over. But with that, I'm excited to introduce our first speaker. We're going to hear a presentation on the governor's FY 2021-22 pre-K budget by Teresa Klebaka, the Education Policy Director for the Governor's Office of Policy and Budget. And you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. May I remove this?
Sure.
To speak? Thank you.
I probably will when I do my presentation. Not for now.
I appreciate that. Good morning, Chairman Fine and staff and members. My name again is Teresa Klebaka. You may hear me referred to as TK. It's a lot easier than Teresa Klebaka. I am the Education Policy Coordinator in the Governor's Office of Policy and Budget. I joined the Governor's Office just about 2 weeks ago, actually a little over 2 weeks ago, and I'm looking forward to working with you in a new capacity. Joining me today is my budget chief and representatives of the Department of Education, and I want to personally thank my budget chief and the EOPB team working with DOE to help prepare the budget recommendations that we will be discussing today. Thank you for inviting us, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, for meeting with us yesterday and kind of highlighting some of your insights and some of the things that you were hoping that we will try to highlight today. Appreciate that. Hopefully we will accomplish your goals. I'd like to start first by talking about the three entities that are within the Office of Policy and Budget, the Department of Education, which encompasses the State Board of Education, and some K-12, as well as post-secondary education, administrative and support functions are in that area. The Office of Early Learning, which of course is administratively coordinated through the Department of Education, and it's for your early learning children, and the Board of Governors of the state university system. Those three entities are within the OPB unit that we oversee. For today's presentation, I will talk about the high-level budget in terms of how education fits within the high-level budget, and then I will kind of tee up my colleague here, Alex Kelly. He's the Chief of Staff of the Department of Education, to help go through some of the details of each of the units. I want to start first with the slide that was presented in the full Appropriations Committee to kind of get us the context of where education fits in the total budget and the general revenue. As you see here on that first slide on the left-hand side, the slide displays $96.6 billion. That's total budget. Of the total budget, you'll see there that education, which is the sort of orange slice? Yes, orange slice, is the second largest budget area behind Health and Human Services with about $27.1 billion, approximately 28% of the total budget. You flip over to the right-hand side, the general revenue only, you will see there that education jumps to the biggest slice of the pie of general revenue, and that is almost 50% at 49.7% of the general revenue budget. And again, as you can see, education is a pretty big chunk of the money that's available through general revenue. Digging down a little bit deeper, we wanted to show you a slide of total funds, which portion of total funds are dedicated to each of the sectors. And today we will talk about the pre-K through 12 budget portion. We have the other ones up there as well, so you could see of the $27.1 billion. And as you can see, that the biggest chunk up there, which is the orange slice, is public schools at about $15.6 billion, makes up a little over half, 57.4% of the total education funding budget and total funding. Early learning makes up about 5.2%, and the State Board of Education is kind of buried in there, and some of the other education, which includes financial aid, which is out of the higher education budget, so we won't be just discussing that one today. What you don't see up there is that the budget also includes about $42 million in reductions for the fiscal year 21-22 budget that's presented to you today. Most of that reduction is due to workload decreases, which rely heavily on estimating conferences. So what you'll see here is basically from the December estimating conference, the up or down, and adjust for workload there. We'll have more details on that later for each of the slides. A $40 million reduction in funding for Schools of Hope Initiative, as well as a 3% administrative expense reductions in operations going forward into the 21-22 budget. It does not include any kind of appropriation of federal COVID-related dollars. It's strictly just the total state and federal dollars for just your regular programs going forward. So the Florida Leads budget, it basically reinforces Governor DeSantis' commitment to the pre-K through 20 system and the sectors that help families and students achieve their goals. And what I'd like to do now, and specifically the budget will include some specific investments we want to highlight. So if I can, Mr. Chairman, and turn it over to Alex to talk through some of those specific investments and hopefully highlight some of the areas that you and I discussed just yesterday.
Go ahead. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, Alex Kelly, Chief of Staff with the Department of Education, and appreciate this opportunity to be here with you to talk through the Governor's Florida Leads budget. So taking a look at early learning, the governor's budget, first and foremost, maintains that rate increase, that per pupil increase that actually was appropriated by this legislature last year, for I think the largest increase in 10 years, give or take, for the voluntary pre-kindergarten program, taking the per pupil, the base student allocation up to $2,486 per student during the school year and $2,122 per student during the summer. The governor's budget also provides $100 million in federal funding authority to provide for rate increases for high-quality school readiness programming. In addition, the governor's budget maintains $10 million for the TEACH program, which provides scholarships for early childhood professionals to work towards earning a degree or credential in early childhood education. And the governor's budget maintains $3.9 million in funding for the HIPPE program, which delivers high-quality school readiness curriculum to families to strengthen early literacy in the home. Taking a look forward at K-12 public schools, the governor's Florida Leads budget recommends a total funding of $22.8 billion, a little more than a 1% increase, almost a 1.3% increase in funding for the total FEFP, which is about $12.9 billion worth of state funding and about $9.9 billion worth of local funding. When compared to the current year, that would represent an increase of almost $286 million, just a little under $286 million in total FEFP funding. And to put that in the context of a student, that would represent more than a almost $233 per student funding increase, taking the total per student funding amount to actually above $8,000, which would be, this recommendation would be a record appropriation per student in the state of Florida. The governor's budget also includes investments, additional investments, increased investments in key FEFP categoricals. The governor's budget includes a $10 million increase in the mental health categorical for a total of $110 million. These are those funds that schools are using to provide school counselors, school psychologists, school social workers to decrease that ratio of those workers to students so that students have that more individual attention if they have a mental health or other related issue. The budget also includes an additional $50 million to the record appropriation that occurred last year that you approved, the $500 million you approved last year for teacher pay increases, including the increases to minimum pay for all teachers in Florida, and then also increases for veteran teachers. And those funds, that additional $50 million, would be allocated the way that the statute that you passed last year appropriates. And then lastly, the governor's Florida Leads budget creates a new Title I school recognition program. If you're familiar with sort of the outgoing school recognition program, it's similar in some respects. The principle of the program is based on, has the school shown improvement or maintained that high letter grade? Although only Title I schools in Florida would be eligible to really provide those greatest resources where they're needed the most, and the definition in this program would ensure that some of those funds are definitely spent on literacy programs, and then, of course, the rest going to teacher and staff bonuses. And then lastly, just taking a little bit of a deeper dive in some of the really important critical K-12 initiatives, the governor's budget, again, includes $2.5 million in funding, maintaining the $2.5 million in funding for the Jewish day schools, for essentially your school hardening type dollars. Governor's budget includes $21 million, essentially enough for 2,000 new scholarships for Gardner Scholarship students. The governor's budget maintains the $10 million appropriation for computer science education that specifically helps our teachers earn certifications and credentials, so actually pays for that opportunity for a teacher to earn a certification and credential in computer science education so they can teach those courses. And then upon getting that credential, that certification, they then get a bonus for earning that. And then lastly, the governor's budget maintains funding for the very strong youth mental health awareness and assistance training that this legislature has supported since 2018, essentially train-the-trainer funding that has allowed training of teachers and other faculty in our schools throughout the state so that they can help students and recognize the signs and symptoms of a student in crisis. And with that, Mr. Chair, members, happy to answer any questions you may have.
Members, are there any questions? Representative Andrade, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. Related to the mental health awareness and assistance training, does that include the mental health services that are provided to students in schools?
You're recognized.
Sure, thank you, Mr. Chair. So the earlier mention of mental health funding in the presentation, on this slide, this is the actual provision of services to the students. This is the school counselors, school psychiatrists, or other services that the schools, if they contract for services, they have some flexibility in how they arrive at spending these funds. But these would be the actual services. And then the funding here is the training of staff to ensure that all staff in our schools have a common understanding of signs and symptoms with students.
You're recognized for the follow-up.
Thank you, Chair. And thanks for the clarification. I appreciate it. My question relates to a bill that was passed last year regarding alleviating the state's burden to cover all health care services for Medicaid-eligible children when they don't have an IEP or a finding of disability in schools. The bill was passed by the legislature last year and signed by the governor, but we're still waiting on ACA to finalize rulemaking and allow school districts to bill Medicaid for those services right now that the state is paying full freight for all those Medicaid-eligible children who don't have IEPs. So I was curious if that has been looked at in the budgeting process at all or considered for you know, projecting out any potential savings that the state might save in the provision of those services going forward.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That issue is not reflected in this proposed budget. We'd be happy to circle around with our partners at ACA and see where they're at on that work and follow back up with you if you'd like.
Good. Thank you.
Okay, I don't know where he is. Representative Roach, oh, there you are. You're recognized for a question, and then after he's done, Representative Williams, you'll be next. You're recognized, Representative Roach.
Chairman, I don't have a question.
Oh, you don't, okay, I was told you did. Sorry, it must have been Representative Williams. You're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
When you spoke about the grades and the resources that certain schools will receive, how are those schools chosen? And I think it started on slide 6 and then you continued on slide 7.
Sure. Recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, great question. So every Title I school in the state of Florida, if a school is designated as a Title I school, that would make them potentially eligible for these funds. Whether or not they get the funds would be dependent upon the letter grade the school gets at the end of the year. So if the school earned an A, or if the school was to increase its letter grade, or if the school was to maintain, if the school, let's say, had a two-letter grade jump previously, if the school was to maintain that letter grade increase, then the school could then actually get these funds. So schools where essentially Title I schools in Florida are, generally speaking, in most cases, your schools where 40% of the students or more are considered to be low-income students. And there are some exceptions of schools that are under, but generally speaking, it means that 40% or more of the students are low-income.
Mr. Chair?
Yep, you're welcome, Ness.
The VPK requires certain requirements to be met. Are you stating that according to the grade level that that school received the year before determines the amount or if they receive funding?
You recognize.
Can I clarify, did you say VPK?
When you, yeah, you spoke about the VPK program with grades, or that's not sure. Including in?
Sure, thank you. Yes, that Title I school recognition only pertains to K to 12 schools. It doesn't pertain to VPK programs.
But
you follow up?
Yeah. Yes, but they are feeding out of the VPK classrooms into the pre-K, correct?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, yeah, so the a K-12 school, even though, yes, of course, those students in most cases did come from a voluntary pre-kindergarten program, in many cases did, the grade, letter grade for a school is not impacted by that program. It's based, in this case, an elementary school. It's based on several metrics that are specific to that school. So if, let's just say this was already in place this year, at the end of this year for that elementary school, if its school grade was an A or its school grade improved a letter grade or improved a couple letter grades, then what would happen is that after that letter grade was determined, the school would get the bonus following that letter grade. So it would reflect that last academic year's letter grade.
Well, you good?
Okay. I have several, but I asked them, you know, before next meeting.
Okay.
I just don't want to hold up on the time.
No, it's okay. Are there any other members? Questions? Yes, Representative, you're recognized. Representative Bartleman.
Can you, with the teacher salary allocation increase, are there any further stipulations? I know last year the 47.5 had to go to all the beginning teachers. Do you want this money? Is this used to increase the middle range teachers, or you're just giving the allocation to the districts to do what they need to do?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this would follow the current statute as the legislature approved it last year.
Okay.
So 40% of the funds, so essentially $40 million, if you were to take the recommendation, $40 million, up to $40 million could go towards increasing the minimum pay for teachers, and then $10 million could go towards your veteran teachers and other classifications of support staff who fall under the statute. The way that the funding works is the law says that districts have to continue to use these funds until they reach an average starting pay of $47,500. At that point, the district actually has the choice. The district could continue to actually increase the minimum pay in the district above $47,500, or at that point, the district is able to take from those funds and move the remainder over to essentially the veteran teacher pay category. That's gonna look different in district to district as this is being implemented this year. Some districts very quickly got to that $47,500 number. Not uncommonly, districts that are either high property tax districts or larger districts, smaller districts, and generally speaking, this isn't 100% true, but generally speaking, smaller, more rural communities would still almost certainly be working their way towards that $47,500 number. So it depends on the school district.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Yep, recognized for a follow-up.
So I just want to make sure I'm clear on this, because I got a lot of pushback from the veteran teachers last year. So if we're already at 47.5, we're there, my district. So then we could take whatever's in this allocation and use it on the schedule for the other teachers who felt shortchanged last year, the older teachers. teachers, the veteran teachers, correct? That's what I'm hearing.
You're recognized?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. Yes, if a district's already at that 47,500 number, then yes, they could move the entirety of those funds over to the veteran teacher pay side.
Okay, and then my last question.
You're recognized for another follow-up.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
New question. With the FTE, if schools are still going to be offering virtual learning at the beginning of next year, are you going to fund them at the full FTE as they're in, as if they were in person?
You're recognized.
Thank you. So the basis for funding some students and what we're calling innovative students, funding them at a full FTE rate, even though they're doing some sort of blended or hybrid learning, maybe they're doing A and B days. The basis for that is based in a waiver of law initially that was done in an emergency order for the fall 2020 semester, and then subsequently a similar emergency order was signed by the commissioner for the spring 2021 semester. So if there was no additional emergency order, then the only option for next year would be to return to funding as normal, which is based in either a student is a brick and mortar attending school in person, or a student is a full-time virtual student. So if there was no extension or re-signing of a new emergency order or change in law for that matter, then funding would return to you as normal next school year.
Okay, thank you.
I would just clarify a couple things. Let's keep in mind, this is the governor's proposed budget. We get to decide what the budget is the first thing. And then the second thing is there shouldn't need to be another emergency order because here we are meeting right now. So hopefully we'll make that decision as a legislature on how we want to move forward. Certainly a lot had to happen in between when we left Tallahassee and now, but now we have the ability to have some say on that. So hopefully there won't be any more of that sort of thing moving forward.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Yep, Representative Williams, yeah. Go ahead.
Piggyback off on when you're speaking of the teacher salary for the 50 to the 550 million, that's going to be a separate line item itself. So that money would not be able to be used other than teacher salaries. Is that correct?
You're recognized.
Correct, Mr. Chair. Yes, both the statute and then the subsequent line item, the General Appropriations Act, are fairly prescriptive. And the statute very specifically even prohibits collective bargaining those funds for any other purpose. So that they must go towards teacher salaries.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. I would note that funding is always fungible. If you were planning to increase teacher salaries by $300 million using other money, you certainly could choose not to do that. So, you know, funding is fungible. Any other questions before we move on to their next presentation? Okay, thank you. I think you may be staying up there. I'm not sure who's doing the next one. We're now gonna get a second presentation from the governor's office, also by Mr. Kelly. This is gonna be an update. As we talked about a little bit last time, and as I'll be talking about a little bit, our schools have been drowning and are drowning in federal funding. COVID, it turns out, is the greatest booster for K-12 education in the history of public education. And so Mr. Kelly is gonna give a presentation updating us on all of the federal assistance that relating to the COVID-19 pandemic for pre-K through 12 education. And so you are recognized to give this presentation.
And thank you again, Chair Fine and members. And again, appreciate the opportunity to continue this dialogue. So here in this presentation, I'm gonna give you an overview of, as the chair mentioned, those federal funds, those CARES Act funds, as they impacted our early learning through K-12 world. Those funds did extend beyond that, but I'm just gonna focus here today on early learning through K-12, childcare through K-12. And these funds relate to our response and our recovery from the pandemic. And of course, I'm gonna focus primarily on those funds that the department actually has had some discretionary role or administrative role in seeing those funds through. So just to give a little bit of context, not to dwell too long here, but just to give a little bit of context, as the CARES Act was passing very late, I think March 27th or March 28th, 2020, eventually those funds started to become accessible in the late spring for the state of Florida and other states. I want to give a little bit of context just as to sort of the seeds, if you will, the roots, if you will, in terms of how those funds were looked at, utilized, prioritized. At that time, back in April, late April last year, Governor DeSantis was even holding a series of meetings, taking feedback from stakeholders on a variety of recovery-related issues to the state of Florida, how to open businesses back up, how to open schools back up, a number of other sectors, but obviously our focus and interest is, relates to the schools and its impact on the state of Florida. Our department engaged, when those funds were kind of coming down in different buckets that I'll get into, our department engaged in a lot of stakeholder feedback from early learning all the way through post-secondary to make sure that we understood the different challenges that were actually facing school districts, early learning providers, post-secondary institutions, and the like at that time. And on the board, you just see some of the consistent themes that, that emerged. You know, I just want to focus on a couple, which is, and probably the two that the commissioner focuses on the most, which is, of course, we needed to look at how is it we reopen schools, how we reopen early learning programs safely. And we took the vantage point, the contextual point of presume you're reopening, presume that you're going to reopen campuses, how would you do so safely? And do so with that moral purpose in mind of understanding that achievement gaps were likely being exacerbating. Achievement gaps overall are already a large part of what we do in terms of how we dedicate resources to our students who need those funds the most. We talked about Title I students earlier. So understand that achievement gaps were likely exacerbating because of this crisis. And so that would warrant a close, careful look at how these funds could be utilized. So just to give a sense of the total landscape, and I included here the higher education fund, even though we're not talking about that, just to give you a sense that in total, the state of Florida took in about $2 billion in what would either be considered education-related or childcare-related funds. Now, in the state of Florida, the entity that receives childcare funds is the Office of Early Learning. So for the purposes of our department, even though that technically, according to federal law, fell outside education, it still all fell under these sort of a fiscal agent administrative purview of our department. That said, many of these funds were not discretionary. There were some funds that were discretionary. In total, give or take about $475 million of those $2 million, our department had either the designated or explicit responsibility for overseeing the administration of those dollars and a level of being responsive to the essentially intent of the act that Congress was trying to get at. So the governor's fund, our department was designated to oversee that fund. That's $173 million. Our department was able to utilize up to 10% of the K-12 funds, so a little more than $77 million, and again, then the child care fund. So again, about $475 million of those $2 million. In total, I'll get into some of the details. In total, 99% of these funds, more than 99%, the end purpose of these funds is very deliberate and connected to the service that's being provided to a Florida education stakeholder, whether that's the family participating in early learning, the actual program itself, the operation of schools, the students in those schools, the educators in those schools, or as somebody involved in the actual stakeholder level education of our children. So the vast majority of these dollars, the vast intent was to get these dollars into the hands of actual recovery on the ground level. And the vast majority of these funds have been obligated to some purpose at this point. Our role as a department, beyond what I'm going to get into, is of course we also have a fiduciary role, a role to ensure that from an integrity perspective, from an audit perspective, we have the role of ensuring that these funds are used appropriately, that we place reasonable, not burdensome, but reasonable controls on these funds to make sure that their end purpose is actually met according to the federal law. And just to, actually I'll take a step back for just a second. And just to put this funding into a broader context, all states have also just recently found out about the second round of stabilization funds, which for simplification purposes, I'll just refer to as CARES 2.0. The full name of that second act is the Coronavirus Response and Relief Supplemental Appropriations Act. You might hear some refer to it as the CARISA Act, but I'll refer to it as CARES 2.0 just to keep that simple. So the second CARES Act, to put this into context, there's an additional, from a K-12 perspective, if you look at that K-12 fund, an additional $3.1 billion that is appropriated for the state of Florida for those purposes. A little more than $2.8 billion, but $2.82 billion is essentially entitlement funds for the school districts Essentially, they work very similar to the way Title I funding would work. The balance of that is within the discretion of the department. In addition to that, the Act also provides $634 million more for the Child Care Fund, and the Act also provides an additional $288 million for the Governor's Fund. What is a little bit different, just sort of a high-level distinction to make between CARES 1 and CARES 2. In CARES 1, for your non-public schools, your non-public K-12 schools, in CARES 1, those schools would get services through equitable services consultation with school districts. So in other words, your non-public schools, your private schools, their funding was wrapped into the district's K-12 funding. The districts, what sometimes we call ESSER funding. In CARES 2, the non-public schools, instead, their funding is broken out and is put into the governor's fund. And the governor's fund, almost three-quarters of that fund, $213 million of that fund, is explicitly for non-public schools. And so for your, this might be a question you might get from constituents in your district, for your non-public schools, they will not be dealing with the school districts for CARES 2 funding. They'll actually be dealing directly with our department. They'll actually apply to our department for those funds. So those funds are specific for that purpose. And again, I think it's helpful overall too, just to understand from a timing perspective, CARES 1 funding has to be obligated by May. The state of Florida's funding was approved in May, so CARES 1 funding has to be obligated by May. It can be spent up through September 2022, but the funds have to be obligated by May for some purpose. CARES 2 funding is similar, except that it just extends those deadlines. CARES 2 funding, generally speaking, CARES 2 funding has to be obligated by January of next year, and then those funds have to be actually spent by the end recipient, whatever they were obligated for, by September 2023. I tend to just simplify this in a sense and say, now that we have these two acts, CARES 1, generally speaking, the purpose of CARES 1 was support for educational school districts, institutions, schools, parents, to get through essentially this school year that we're in right now and perhaps a little beyond. And generally speaking, the CARES 2 Act is meant to, in effect, support next school and the year after that. The Congress essentially took a viewpoint that there could be a 3 years worth of an educational safety and educational attainment impact. So in terms of what the specific funding buckets actually require, I'm not going to really go through these next three slides. They're really just there more for your background, and obviously can answer any questions regarding them if you like. But just in general, there's the next three slides just give you a little more detail about the Governor's Fund, the K-12 Fund, again, which sometimes is called the ESSER Fund, and the Child Care Fund. So, in terms of how decisions were made, in terms of the value add, understanding these were dollars that had an emergency purpose, they were needed to mobilize these dollars to help educational stakeholders at all levels get ready for education as quickly as possible, how to get students back on campus safely, how to get educators back on campus safely. Overall, we took three general approaches to viewing these dollars and how to prioritize these dollars. And so we tracked the comments from stakeholders that we received from all levels with a great focus. I mentioned achievement gaps earlier, particularly for low-income students, students who have a lack of access also potentially, depending upon their circumstances, often related to income. We also secondarily focus on students who were at key transitions. So for example, a senior who's about to go to college, a dramatic key transition, and so our seniors took great precedence. Our students who were transitioning from pre-K to kindergarten, understanding that's a huge transition for them. Our students transitioning from a literacy perspective from third grade to fourth grade, it's where you go from learning to read to reading to learn. If you're not on grade level by fourth grade in terms of reading, that student's in a lot of trouble, and it becomes incrementally more and more difficult for that student to catch up because they're using literacy skills for other learning. And we recognize that just losing a few months' time at the end of the spring 2020 semester could be very dramatic for a student who was just maybe about to make it or just maybe not going to make it. So just to dive into some detail about how these funds have been allocated, how these funds are being utilized, and as noted earlier, the chairman noted, these funds are still being utilized. So just to give some additional context, the next few slides all relate to early learning funding, and I just want to give one summative point regarding and then give a couple details. Overall, around mid-April, we were at a place where only 42% of our state's school readiness and VPK providers were open. We were at a place where first responders, law enforcement, were struggling to have someone look after the child while they were trying to get to work to serve us and to make sure that we could all be safe and our state could recover. Only 42% of our programs, we were really at a critical mass point where the early learning world potentially could have collapsed. And so a lot of these funds, just a summary point to them all, was they all in different ways were trying to help that world sustain itself so that we didn't have essentially a collapse to our childcare system, which would have really prevented many people from getting to work, as we well know. And so at the time, about 42% of our early learning programs were open. Today, right now, around 98.6% of those early learning programs are open. So it was really critical, right on the front end, right immediately, to turn that dial. And so the funds on the screen, just to dive a little deeper, $52.8 million so far has been used for what was used for the phase one of emergency child care relief grants that serve 6,500 school readiness and VPK providers and also non-contracted providers, so VPK providers, but who maybe don't contract with the state of Florida, to support those providers if they were actually still open by April 30. So immediately the first thing was help sustain those that are still open. Thereafter, additional money, phase two of these funds was utilized to essentially help those providers who were not open on April 30th, but how could we get them back open? So if they opened up by August 31st, then they became eligible for the second pot of funding. And continuing on a similar theme, the third phase, again, supporting those programs that were not open by April 30th, but reopened by August 31st, but expanding the pool of programs that were eligible in this case. So originally the first funding that went out was for those programs that had a class assessment score by the state of Florida. And in this case, programs that did not have a class assessment score, essentially your assessment of quality of your school readiness programs. This allowed more providers to participate. So an additional 3,100 providers participated in phase three. And then phase four served those programs that opened up thereafter, that opened up by October 15. So if they were perhaps not open by August 30 or 31st, but then they were able to open by August 15. So again, trying to bring more and more of those providers online. In total, over 1,150 early learning providers of different types received some of these funds to help ensure that they could open, they had cleaning and sanitation supplies, they had funds to make sure that their staff could be compensated appropriately, that they could retain their staff for that matter. And this was critical to helping support those communities. In addition to that, this next funding source was specifically for, this $90.8 million was specifically for, when I mentioned earlier, those children of healthcare, of law enforcement, of first responder families, to make sure that obviously they could continue to go out and serve us. One of the first things that we did was launch this with the help of different healthcare associations and other first responder law enforcement partners, Florida sheriffs, to make sure that we were serving those communities. And these funds provided additional funding to any program that was serving these children. And so it was a very, very helpful point when we were at a time when many of these critical care workers could not actually get to work. In total, I want to say about almost 29,000 children have been served through this program. And those children have, at one point in time, I think the max, about 22,000 were in the program at any one point in time. In addition, coming back to key transitions, funding was allocated to help that key transition of pre-K to kindergarten. So essentially for your rising kindergartners, young people who were identified either by their educational metrics in VPK or identified by their teacher as needing that support. And those funds went from summer even into the fall to provide those supports and help basically those students who, because of the pandemic, were most likely to struggle upon entering kindergarten. Moving a little further now, moving into the K-12 world, and some of this actually does, a little bit of this actually does cross over into higher ed, but I'll focus on the K-12 side. Moving into the K-12 world, similar to the Rising Kindergarten program, also $64 million was utilized for our school districts so that our districts could provide supports and interventions for students who were pretty most commonly in the earlier grades, particularly for literacy skills, were identified as likely to struggle in their transition, their progression to the next grade. Because many students in those last couple months when it was kind of the make it or break it time in the spring 2020 semester, they lost those in-person supports. So students who needed that the most lost those supports, obviously through no fault of anybody's, but these were dollars to help the students during the summer. And school districts actually, if they've not fully utilized these funds, they're actually still utilizing some of these funds now for their providing supports and interventions for students who, in some cases, are returning from distance learning, or in other cases, are just struggling with their, and the progress monitoring assessments are telling us that they're struggling, and they're not keeping up on grade level. And so for the same type of purpose, but even into the fall and spring, some school districts, if they had available funds here, they're actually still using these to support those students and really try to help make sure that in a year's time, they're learning a year's worth of content. This next $1 million, we forged a partnership with the Urban League and two of their regional locations, one in Central Florida, one in Miami-Dade. And it's really a partnership that actually connects the early learning world and the college world, because the purpose of the program was to identify adults who have kids who have struggling, particularly literacy skills, struggling early educational metrics, and adults who probably, you know, I'll use the example, if you think about Central Florida, how many Floridians perhaps worked in the hotel industry and suddenly discovered how economically vulnerable they are. And so at that point, they suddenly realized they thought they had a good job, and they suddenly realized they needed that credential. And so this is actually supporting both the adult and the child, and beyond obviously providing that immediate support, which is very much needed. At the same time, this also helps give us an insight into, does this kind of model of service delivery actually work? So it was a really kind of neat partnership between our post-secondary and early learning world. Moving on further into literacy, just some highlights here. Much of what we've done focused on literacy. Much of what we've done recognized that particularly early literacy, although not just early literacy, but particularly early literacy, that these skills, falling behind in these skills, would have years long, not just maybe 1 year, but several years long consequences, maybe lifelong consequences for students who were just caught up in this wave of the pandemic. So funding is used for supporting our reading coaches and really upskilling our reading coaches. We've been partnering with the Lastinger Center at the University of Florida, the Florida Center for Reading and Research, UCF and FAU on increasing the skill sets for our reading coaches. Also in providing an additional this year 2,000 endorsements, I should say, for our actual literacy teachers. So in getting 2,000 more teachers with a literacy endorsement, and also using these funds to that literacy endorsement's done through the Lastinger Center at the University of Florida. We're also using these funds to actually create an alternative literacy endorsement pathway so that we can have two pathways in the state of Florida. Moving on, the funds were also used to provide regional supports for our school districts. Much was being asked in this plan for our districts to manage regarding literacy. And so this plan actually funds for 2 years, actually basically regional literacy supports, what we call our literacy SEAL Team 6. These actual 20 staff around the state, they're all embedded in one school district, and they serve a cluster of school districts. And essentially, they are all-star literacy coaches, if you will, providing those supports at all levels, providing professional development for our literacy coaches, for our teachers. In all cases, they've updated a customized plan for every school district. They're working where they can get into schools, working in individual schools, building out the literacy leadership of all those schools. Cool. Thank you. Is that a hint? Okay.
5 to 10 more minutes.
Yes, sir. In addition, funds were utilized to actually help provide best practice curriculum that's evidence-based and proven to actually provide impactful results. And so districts are essentially using these curriculum dollars like mini grant dollars to purchase best practice curriculum for their districts. In addition to support this work. Much of what we've done this year, both within the CARES Act funding and beyond it, relates to progress monitoring supports for our districts. Many districts were progress monitoring, all of our districts were progress monitoring already for early grades. This really expanded that through grades 8 and 10 for ELA and math. And these progress monitoring supports include actually providing the funding for data scientists in our school districts so they can essentially take that war room approach, if you will, to actually monitor this data, manage it, and actually then support schools that are trying to support these struggling learners. We've also procured tools to help our school districts. From a progress monitoring standpoint, we worked with our current test vendor in the state of Florida to then create a progress monitoring tool that districts and charter networks could use totally for free. So we provided that to them. And so many of them are using that as their progress monitoring tool. And some of them are using that to supplement their progress monitoring tools. In addition to that, we've worked with another vendor who is actually helping us aggregate all of that data throughout the year, that progress monitoring data, because school districts, most school districts tend to use one of three or four different well-known vendors, and then probably about 25% of the school districts use locally custom-made progress monitoring tools. And so we're working with a vendor to actually make sure that we have that aggregate data and we can work with all districts collectively. In addition, utilizing these funds to manage our actual capturing of that data. Our actual capturing of the data is being moved into the cloud, allowing us to better provide those services back and forth between school districts, and the vision is one day even to parents. Similar to the reading curriculum, much work this past year when the pandemic first hit was occurring regarding civic literacy, and much of that work was interrupted. And so these funds are allowing civic literacy related, are allowing our school districts to catch back up on that work. From a curriculum perspective, you may recall that last year when the state updated its English language arts standards, civic literacy curriculum was actually embedded into the English language arts standards throughout K-12. And so these curriculum funds allow districts to purchase those best practice curriculum, and then likewise supporting our school districts, who some of whom were actually independently on their own engaging in local civic literacy projects, completely interrupted by the pandemic. This is allowing them to catch up and to support them. In addition, again, our students in key transitions, $8 million to support students who might need an attempt or another attempt to take the SAT or ACT, but don't have the personal funds to do so. So this is making sure that that is funded for this school year for those students. And lastly, or I should say next to last, but I'll go quick, we provided $2 million in telehealth funding for 18 rural school districts that need the additional support given their rural nature and the ability to garner those resources that maybe a larger school district or a moderate-sized school district more easily gather. So $2 million in grants for those school districts. We're doing instructional continuity work with our districts, recognizing that as the hurricane state, we're no stranger to potential school closures. And obviously, this past year has been unique. But at the end of the day, we have to take these best practices that we've learned this past year and have all school districts up their A game in terms of instructional continuity during a crisis. And so these dollars will allow us to support those districts, even including providing temporary staff in those districts to do this work. And then kind of lastly, our safety nets. We provided $15 million in grants that were specific to private schools. And these were focused around those schools that had 50% or more students coming from the state's different scholarship programs, recognizing the significant investment you've made in those programs, and that obviously we want those schools who are supporting students who were having learning challenges, we want those schools to be solid, to continue on, and so these dollars refer those schools. In addition, Florida Virtual School had already made and was continuing to make a significant investment in a true safety net learning management system that when completed could actually at any given time support 4 million students in the state of Florida, could support all public school students and even a lot of private school students. And so Florida Virtual had out of their own pocket made much of this investment. In part, this was reimbursing them for that investment, and then it was providing funding to complete that. And on top of that, Florida Virtual has since the beginning of the pandemic for free, been providing training and supports for school districts, charter schools, private schools, all schools that wanted training in terms of how a teacher can teach through a virtual learning management system. And so this was a little bit of money just to support the time that they were spending and up to that point for free doing that work. And Mr. Chairman, with that, happy to answer your questions.
Thank you. I'm going to ask a couple questions first because I was so focused on getting other people's questions, I didn't ask the questions I had in the last presentation. So I'll do those first. I want to focus on a couple of these just as an example of these projects. So let's just run through them fairly quickly. If we can go back to slide 11, I'm just going to read off a few of these. Successful transition to kindergarten, $14 million. If we can go to slide 12. Urban League supports for students literacy and adult upskilling, $1 million. Go to the next page. Upskill highly effective reading coaches, $5 million. Next capacity building for reading, $5 million. Next page. It's page 14, one back. Ensuring high quality regional reading supports, $5 million. Ensuring the best curriculum for reading, $20 million. Next page. All of these relating to data. Next page. The great curriculum for $4 million, supporting school districts for $1 million, and then lastly on the next page, the ACT for $8 million. I probably could point out a few more of these. While they're all noble things, I don't think any of us would disagree that any of these are necessarily bad, the federal money was supposed to address expenses that we only have as a result of COVID. And so my question to you is what, and you don't need to go through each one in detail, but if you want to pick, you know, a couple and I may follow up, what do these actually have to do with responding to COVID as opposed to things that you might ask us to fund through our regular budgetary process and things like that?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Absolutely. We have a great appreciation for that and understand that's also part of our role is to make sure that as these funds are utilized, they're utilized for those purposes. So just to work with the example for the one that's on the screen, ACT and SAT, we know and we've seen this both in the K-12 world, high school, and also in the post-secondary world. There are a lot of families this year that when they look at the possibility of post-secondary education, they're right on the border between they can afford that expense or they can't. Maybe mom or dad's lost their job. And maybe in the case of that student, that extra $40 to take that test might not exist. And that student might need another time on that test. And so those are dollars that are directly related to the economic impacts of COVID-19, of the pandemic. On that family, we recognize that they were really on the border. And so it's just one example. Be happy to go through others.
Go do the great curriculum for $4 million. Walk me through how that was a necessary expenditure in order to deal with the unique situation of COVID. Not that I disagree. I'm glad we have these standards and everything else. I just want to know why this was a COVID issue.
Sure, Mr. Chair. So if you reflect back on actually around this time last year, actually going back to January of last year, Governor DeSantis made an announcement regarding civic literacy and actually challenged Florida school districts to do greater instruction and testing of high school students, not for any purpose of accountability, but for the purpose of post-secondary readiness when it comes to civic literacy. And the thing the governor was looking at was that in the post-secondary world, in our universities and colleges, there's actually an assessment that's utilized for post-secondary credit that relates to a number of questions that relate to things like U.S. Supreme Court cases, a number of issues that relate that you should learn in high school in American government in history. And the governor actually challenged our high schools in the state of Florida to actually voluntarily adopt that test at the high school level. More than 30 school districts, 250, 260 schools were actually doing that work, and they were increasing. We had just literally published February 12th a list of actual civic literacy text aligned to our new best standards. And so those districts were actually doing that work to provide that instruction. Well, of course, what happened about a month later, at that point, obviously the full impact of COVID started to become a reality for us. And so that work halted. Money was spent, tests were being developed by districts, resources were being looked at, expenses were being made, and so these are resources to essentially help those schools and districts, and we specifically reached out to those 30 districts first to make sure, and then of course we made these funds available broader than that, but we were specifically looking at those districts that had made an investment in money and time, and actually because the pandemic completely lost that investment in money and time.
So I guess I'm a little bit confused because we didn't cut the budget. So the funds that we anticipated spending in K through 12 education, we spent. So anything they were planning to do before COVID, they had the funds to do it. So I'll ask the question again, just to use this example. I probably won't go through them all because I think this one might make the point for me. What about this $4 million? And again, I pointed out seven or eight examples. Is unique that we had to spend $4 million in order to respond to COVID. I would understand if the K through 12 budget got cut, but it didn't. So what about this was a necessity due to respond uniquely to COVID? Don't disagree with anything you said about it being a good idea. That's not the issue here. How is this a response to COVID as opposed to just sort of a good, hey, we got a bunch of cash from the federal government and let's do some good things, even if they don't have to do with COVID?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So under the CARES Act, it would be allowable if a school district or school or any entity for that matter was intending on using dollars for one purpose and had to divert those funds for another purpose because of a crisis. And I'll give you an example because, of course, as you're pointing out, we're talking about dollars that were discretionary for the districts that they had to then essentially divert. They had time invested, dollars spent, and where they still had dollars, they had to divert funds, they had to divert time to other issues. I'll give you an example. So when you think about what our districts were going through at that particular time, and you think about how they're funded. So I'll use food as an example. So when school districts, once school campus closures occurred and school districts were providing food services to students, 72% of our students in the state of Florida rely on our schools for at least one meal a day. About 60% rely on our schools for two meals a day. For those students, those schools were spending more money on food services. So where they had discretionary funds, where they had staff, they might have been moving the bus driver over to help with food services. They were collapsing their resources around what was necessary because they were in a situation where they wanted to provide, they felt the need to provide those funds. They were allowed to provide those supports to our students, including it might have been delivering of food. There are other examples, but our schools and our school districts had to collapse funds around critical services to maintain continuity of operations. Our schools, in many cases, were quickly propping up virtual classrooms. That required immediately accessing any funds that were available, any discretionary funds they had. So in terms of then other impacts, that has a direct impact then on the ordinary course of business and even discretionary course of business the school district was planning on engaging in. And so we took a look at that. We took that feedback directly from districts, directly from other education stakeholders. And where we saw that critical projects, critical work was diverted because funds had to be diverted, we looked at those issues, and this was one that we thought was a high-value proposition for about 30 of our school districts.
Okay, and I don't think we're going to see eye to eye on this, but I'll ask my last question, and then I'll give my colleagues a chance to ask them. So you're saying, okay, we had to do this $4 million. Just use this one example. We could do this on a whole bunch of these because they didn't have the money because they were diverting it to all these important things. I'm about to give a presentation after you're done. They got $693 million from the federal government to deal with those things, the overwhelming majority of which they haven't spent. So if they had all of these things and they didn't spend all the $693 million they got to do that, why did they need $4 million for good standards for civic literacy? I struggle, and I'll let you answer, and then we'll move on, with the vast majority of these things sound like good ideas that aren't necessarily COVID response ideas. So anyway, about why the $693 million? Why couldn't they have used that to meet these needs that you talked about?
Sure, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so for something like the $693 million in ESSER funds that the districts have already received, essentially their entitlement funds from the CARES Act for the districts, again, they're distributed akin to Title I funding. Those funds, Congress passed that law in late March. Those funds became available to the districts during the summer. Those funds, the districts, in most cases, including talking with a number of superintendents, they're using those funds in a month-to-month schedule because they're using those funds for specific purposes during the year. For example, perhaps they've hired more nurses. Perhaps they have a regular supply of cleaning and sanitation supplies that they're restocking every single month. And so those funds are meant to last them potentially up through September 2022, at least during the course of this school year. And so most school districts, from talking with superintendents, from working with them, most of them are using those funds on a scheduled basis throughout the school year. Not to say that they couldn't have used funds for these purposes. Small limitations, those funds can only go back to March of last year. So if there was an expense that they had incurred and essentially became wasted prior to March, they couldn't explicitly use it for that. But I don't, you know, that's obviously just a few weeks. Overall, though, those expenses that districts have, they're using those funds for, they're regular and recurring throughout this specific school year. We created a number of flexibilities for our school districts, recognizing their challenges weren't just based on what was going to be in front of them this school year. Their challenges and their financial reality was shaken in many ways. Our school districts, even their ordinary recurring expenses, transportation's a great example. School districts are running more bus routes in most cases.
I want to see if, does anybody else have any questions on this? Ranking Member Wilhite, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll follow up on your question just a little bit there, Mr. Chairman. I can understand how free SAT and ACT may affect every student that is having difficulty, and their parents may be having difficulty during COVID. So that's across the board, money for every student. But on your progress monitoring to inform teaching practices, $10 million. For instance, you talk about only 35 districts are using this tool. How is that helping everybody in the state if only 35 out of the 67 counties? So in theory, if every district, every county has a school district, you're only hitting half of them. Is that fair and equitable across the entire state that you're only hitting half of them then?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So yes, great question. So these funds were this assessment, this opportunity to use this assessment was made available to every single district and school in the state. So it was voluntary. A number of districts and schools already utilized a particular progress monitoring tool, and so many of them were already satisfied with the tools that they had procured locally. This was providing an additional resource to those districts voluntarily for them if they wanted to take us up on this. So it was an opportunity that they wouldn't have to take. The other points on this slide, though, the collective package of progress monitoring supports collectively do support every single district and every single school in the state of Florida. And so if in some cases some districts just chose not to take advantage of those supports, we wouldn't have ever wanted to force that assessment on them.
Yep, follow up.
I guess I would ask on your page 11, when you talk about first responder healthcare workers, how was that advertised or offered to first responders for this possibility for assistance?
You recognize.
What was the marketing, I should say, for that, and how did you market people?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd be happy to follow up and get you a detailed answer because that deserves a detailed answer. Just in general, we worked with a number of associations that represent these employees, that represent these workers, to make sure that through those associations, we communicated to their membership about the availability. So we really had some great partners from those specific associations, the Florida Hospital Association, the sheriffs, others, to really make sure that we reach those workers. But again, we're happy to give you a detailed answer to that question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Follow, and I guess I would look, hospitals are important, but I'd say our cops and firefighters is what I'm looking at more detailed on, because I consider those first responders, and that's the area that I'm missing that communication on. So, and my final question, Mr. Chairman, would be on your, I think it's on page 19, when you talk about private school stabilization grants, that additional $15 million, were all private schools included in all this other funding, and this is a specific additional $15 million specifically just for private schools?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, yes. Representative, any time that a public school district, what funding was made available to a public school district, as these are federal funds, by federal law, equitable services had to be offered from that public school district to the private schools, no matter the large or small dollar amount. So any of these funding, private schools have a right to consult with those districts for essentially their equitable share, their equitable services based on those. Yes, sir, to your question, this was just an additional fund for private schools that was dedicated to them.
Mr. Chairman, my question would be why? What made them any different?
And last question.
All the other schools, and that was it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, in the case of, if you think about why would non-public schools get this additional offering compared to public schools? public schools didn't have any funds cut from them. So public schools had a foundation where they were struggling. They had their routine costs going up significantly. But at the end of the day, public schools had a guaranteed funding source that through whatever difficult time, their funding was guaranteed. In the case of a private school, their funding is not guaranteed. So if you have a number of parents, for example, and you could have a school where, let's say, 50 of the students are on state scholarships, 50 of the students private pay, if 20 or 30 of your private paying students, if their parents can no longer afford tuition, that alone could collapse that private school. So in many cases, these small private schools were hosting large percentages of our scholarship students that obviously this state has invested in. And so we were trying to make sure that those schools could manage this, knowing their economy of scale was very, very fragile compared to a public school.
Thank you. And I can back that up. I actually met with the superintendent of Catholic schools today, and they actually educate 25% of the private schools, or private school students who attend private school in the state, and their numbers went off a cliff after COVID happened, and that has continued, which will be relevant to our future discussions. So I know there are other members who have questions, and I'm going to try to get to them, but I'm going to ask Mr. Kelly to stay. I'm going to give a short presentation, which also digs into some of these things, and then we will answer questions about all of that, because we only have about 25 minutes left. Representative Federhoff and Representative Bartleman, you will be first. If you have any questions. So I want to start, we're going to give this sort of an overview of, so what Mr. Kelly has talked about was the state spending. And I want to remind people what federal money has allowed us to do. First, our school districts had zero budget cuts, despite obviously our revenues going off a cliff because of COVID. But the budget that we passed was spent in full, despite the fact that there weren't people being driven to school, there weren't utility bills and these sorts of things. In addition, this year, schools have gotten $700 million of funding to educate students who are not attending. So there's been $700 million of extra funding. There's no cost associated with those students since they're not attending. And then we talked about the $174 million governor's fund. Mr. Kelly talked about the $77 million that the governor had from the K through 12 fund. He also talked about the $223 million in child care. But what about the schools themselves? I asked that question. So there have been two rounds of CARES Act. We're calling it ESSER here. And this is money that's flowing through the Department of Education to the schools. There's a $693 million back when CARES was done right when COVID started. And then in December, CARES 2 did another $2.8 billion to our schools. And just so you all know, right now, Congress is talking about a third avalanche of money for schools. In addition to the money that we have already gotten here. By the way, in the ESSER round two, there was another $624 million for childcare. So with that as the basis, what's been spent? So COVID's a crisis. Go back. Let me just hit the highlights first. $277 million of the $693 million has been spent to deal with the COVID crisis. None of the $2.8 billion. There are deadlines. You can use this for dealing with COVID, preparing, preventing, responding to COVID. That is what this is limited to. And the ESSER round one money, you know, has to be spent reasonably soon. The ESSER round two has to be spent through, they've got a couple of years to do it. But again, an avalanche of funding in addition to what Mr. Kelly spoke about that was done at the state level. So how has that been spent? Next slide. So to school districts, only 40% of the amount that was budgeted has actually been spent thus far, 40%. And then the rest of this talks about the projects that Mr. Kelly mentioned about. The DOE got to keep 10% of the money, and you can see there were some questions, for example, about the free SAT. You can see it up there. But even at the DOE level of the $77 million that was approved, they have spent, I believe it is 8%. Of that money thus far. 92% of it has not been spent, less than, only about 30% of it has even been approved for projects at this point. So 60% of the school district money hasn't been spent on CARES 1. And 92% of the state money has not been spent on CARES 1. But interestingly, and again, as far as I could tell, COVID should have affected every school district the same. I mean, you know, the disease was everywhere, but somehow in the response to CARES money, districts have had radically different uses for the funding. This is the percentage of funding that has been dispersed by district. And if we go to just back to the first previous slide, you can see we've got some that have spent 0 to 10% of their funding so far. My county, Brevard County, is at 20%. You can see 21 to 30, and we're going every county's in there, so you can look up your own in a minute. But 31 to 40, you can go to the next slide. And you get all the way up to 81 to 90. Sarasota County is 89%. Palm Beach County, 87%. And one of the things that we're going to explore in this committee is, why does Brevard County only spend 20% of money dealing with this unprecedented crisis, but Sarasota County or Palm Beach County spend almost 90%? And you can see huge variations. But net-net, to deal with this unprecedented time where we have $2.8 billion more dollars coming, we've only spent 40% of the money that we had previously been given. We can go to the next page. This will be in your packet. You can, in alphabetical order, you can just see each county, what their allocation is, and how much they have spent. You can see Bradford with 3%, Monroe, you know, just take your pick. Everyone will obviously be interested in looking at their own county. But what you can see is radically different percentages based on different counties. And we're going to deal with that. And then we've got our special school districts here at the end. All right, so round two. Spent 40% of CARES 1 thus far, 8% at the state level, but Washington didn't think that was enough. So they're sending us another $3.1 billion. $2.8 billion will go to districts. None of that has been dispersed thus far. The Department of Education gets to retain $313 million. None of that has been, I believe, allocated thus far as well. So another $3.1 billion of money borrowed from our kids and grandkids to pay for unprecedented COVID problems. And again, apparently, if we believe what we hear in Washington, more is on the way. Next slide. These are the school districts, and let's just hold on. I'll just do my county here. So my school district in Brevard County got $64 million. You can just see this in the slide. This is the total amount. So $64 million in the round two, bringing their total to $81 million. So again, in my county, they've spent 20% of their first chunk, and then they're going to get another $64 million on top of it, all borrowed from Jacob and his friends and the children that he doesn't even have yet. Next slide. No, keep going. All right, we're getting close to the end here. All right, so that lays it out. And I will say, before you get into questions, at our next meeting, we will be having five superintendents join us who will be talking about how they are spending this money. So we'll have a chance. We can't ask all 67 to show up, obviously, but we're going to have five come, and we're going to ask them to talk about it. So with that, didn't take that long. We have 17 minutes left. So if we want to return to questions to Mr. Kelly or to me, I'm happy to answer them. But I know that Representative Federhoff was waiting to ask a question. Representative Federhoff, you're recognized to ask Mr. Kelly the question that you had from before.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Kelly, something that's been brought to my attention by my school district and may not be on y'all's radar right now is because students are learning from home rather than using textbooks, a textbook that could be used for three years for three different students, essentially, until it's no longer viable, basically. They've now had to switch over to these students are learning online, and they're having to pay for each of those students to get an access code. So the cost is changing, and it's probably about as much for that one student as would have been three students using that same textbook. And so there's going to be an increase in cost in just their materials that they need for their classes. And that's, you know, an access code for each of their classes. They're taking seven classes. You know, you can see where this could turn into a real cost. It's something that I'm not sure that's on y'all's radar right now, just because it's not something we would necessarily have thought about. But I just wanted to put it out there that it's something that my county in particular is already looking at having to deal with as an increased cost to teaching our kids. Thank you.
You're recognized.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And we'll be happy to follow up, too. I'd love to get a few more details. In general, certainly, districts are using a lot of the funds that you talked about for increased curriculum costs, especially for that situation, perhaps, where a student self-isolates and transitions home temporarily and then is back in school a week or two later. And so that student is temporarily learning through two different modalities. And so curriculum costs overall have gone up. Districts have used a lot of CARES Act funding and other flexible funds to support that curriculum. And again, we'll be happy to follow up and learn more about that specific situation.
Chair.
You're recognized.
So I guess the other thing is that there's not been enough time to negotiate the prices. They're basically having to pay for whatever they have to pay for something like that, rather than being able to negotiate their textbooks and really have a chance to research what they're working with. So, I mean, there's an increased cost just right there with not being able to have the time to negotiate. So just something to look at, but thank you.
Representative Bartleman, you're recognized for a question.
I have a question for him and a question for you.
Okay.
Of the dollars you have that weren't expended in the first round, charter schools and private schools were part of that lump, correct?
I couldn't really hear you. Could you say that again?
The first round of the ESSER funding, I believe charter schools and private schools were part of that allotment to the districts, correct?
You're recognized.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's a great point that you're bringing up,
too. Because they're not spending their money. That's part of the holdback here, I believe.
You're right.
Yes, and in fact, from district to district, as the chair was bringing up the point, really district to district, you're seeing these variations. From talking with some school districts, for example, when you look at those data points, in some cases, almost all of the funds remaining might be the district's funds, and the charters and privates have actually utilized their resources. And in other cases, it's the reverse. It really is from, you bring up a great point, from district to district, it is different. And each district, you'd really have to work with them and talk with them and understand, is it the district's funds that are remaining, or is it the charters, or is it the privates, or is it all of the above? It's different from every district.
I think that since we're trying to tackle this.
You're recognized for follow-up.
Oh, sorry, sir.
It's all right.
I was going to say, since this is a great chart, like, I'm very concerned about all of this that you brought up, I would just ask that if we could get the follow-up, because if a large percentage of this is your charters and your private schools, it casts a shadow on the school district. So I think we need to drill down to figure out what that is.
That's a fair ask, and we can see if we can,
okay.
We can look into that.
And then?
Yeah, you're recognized.
Thank you. Okay, so here's my big question for about how you decided to spend the money, the governor, like how you dispersed in your allotment. So I noticed you did $4 million for iCloud purchases. Most school districts have iClouds already and contracts that exist that they're spending out of general revenue. You're doing the ongoing assessment, the progress monitoring assessment. Many school districts use iReady and they already have those. But I guess my issue is flexibility. When I hear Chair Fine speak about this is supposed to be used for COVID. So for me, we know there's regression. We know over the summer, many of the students did not recoup those skills. You talk about tier two and tier three instruction. There's nothing in here about putting more instructional time in for the kid. You had the summer program with the Urban League, but especially for next year, this summer, and as we go back to face-to-face, we need more face-to-face instruction time for those students who have regressed. And that, to me, is where the money's spent. And when you talk about tier two and tier three instruction, which has to do with response to intervention in kids who can't read. So I'm a teacher with 25 kids in my classroom, and 70% of them are in tier two and tier three, which means that I have to provide individualized instruction for all of them. I cannot do that. It is impossible for one teacher to. You just can't. So any discussion about putting more, you have regional reading coaches, you have all these top people that you're adding, but there are no boots on the ground for the classroom, and that's what the people need. The teachers need boots on the ground, someone who's gonna pull out and do interventions. And most schools, even Title I, only have one reading coach for the whole school.
So that's my
big question, and thank you.
Sure, and you're bringing up some great points. So when you think about how these funds that were of some level of discretion for the state work and partner with the funds that we were talking about earlier, the $693 million that is an entitlement for the districts, those funds for the districts, those funds support the on the ground, the boots on the ground, in terms of who's actually providing the classroom instruction. And we're definitely seeing across a number of school districts, not all, but a number of school districts, they are doing things like providing more Saturday academies, earlier and later hour supports. They have many teachers. In many cases, those funds are being utilized to support teachers who are working overtime, the additional number of substitutes that schools have needed to provide these additional services. In a number of cases, too, where districts are, for example, if they have 11 kids in the classroom and 5 kids at home, they're bringing in an additional support staff because obviously that teacher now has a much more complicated job with some students learning at home. So districts are spending money that way, too. So these dollars are meant to work in tandem. Certainly those local dollars, that $693 million, that's where you're going to get the boots on the ground who are actually in the classroom. These dollars were envisioned as how can we support that, knowing, again, the great points you're bringing up about the challenges that our schools and districts are facing.
And to give you some perspective, Broward County in round one, and round two is like 3 times as big, round one got $62 million, 78% of it they haven't spent. So there's plenty of money. I don't know why, maybe some of it's private schools or charter schools, but they would be a great example of a county that the overwhelming majority of their funds to respond to the crisis of COVID have not been requested. And that's data as of February 5th. That's not even old. We get this number updated every week. Members, are there any other questions? Ranking Member Wilhite, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is to you, Mr. Chairman, or the presenter. How was it decided that each county got that percentage that they were allowed to be distributed to? Because I look at, for instance, and I'm going to look at the bigger ones, Dade, Per Hour, Palm Beach, Orange County. I'd say Palm Beach is probably pretty close to Orange County, but Orange County's gotten $55 million at 34%, but Palm Beach has only got $39 million at 87%. So how were the percentages allocated to those? Was it per student? Did they have to put in budget requests? How was that distributed to them by percentage?
I'm happy to answer that quickly. It's based on Title I students, and that was part of the federal law. That wasn't their decision or our decision, but it's allocated based on pro rata Title I students. It was part of the federal law. I don't know if you have anything you'd like to add to that.
You got it.
Yeah. So if you don't like how it was allocated, call your congressman, I guess. Any other questions?
And one more.
Let me see if anybody else wants a first bite at the apple first. Anybody else? Okay, Representative Bartleman, you're recognized again.
In the chart, also, can you find out, in addition to private and charter, I know that our funds are encumbered but not spent. They're allocated for summer and spring enrichment. So I think we need to have that data as well, because a lot of them are encumbered but have not been spent, and that would change the numbers on this chart dramatically.
Sure.
Okay, thank you.
And we will work on that. And that's true. But again, part of the interesting takeaway here is the vast disparity. If they were all 40%, you would say, okay, something's going on. But some of them have spent basically nothing, and some of them have spent all of it. And is Palm Beach County, which is like at 90%, that much different than Broward County that would explain 22% here, 90% there? Something doesn't seem right. Any other questions? Okay, well, if not, I think this was a great meeting. Just so everyone knows, we are going to meet next week, so the every other week is over. We'll be meeting next Thursday, February 18th, from 10 to noon, right back here in this meeting. Our focus at that meeting is going to be on the FEFP, and specifically, we're going to be talking a lot about the 87,000 missing or phantom students and the phantom funding that is associated with that. And we will have a panel of superintendents here that will be talking not only about how they've been spending their federal dollars, but what's going on in their districts about missing students and how they were seeking to either make sure they're getting educated through homeschool or private school, or to get them back into school. So that's what we'll be focused on that. With that, members, this concludes our committee agenda. Is there any further business before the committee? All right, seeing none, Representative Bartleman moves we rise.